Oh yeah. We are back for another episode of the Baseball Prospectus Podcast Network. And today I am joined by a not so new co-host, but new in the sense that he has not been on for a while, Jarrett Seidler, to talk about the Cincinnati Reds. Jarrett, how's it going today?
Oh, pretty good. I will warn everybody, I wrote this list quite some time ago at this point, because I actually wrote these in like November and December. I did the Reds for the annual, or at least the Reds prospects for the annual. And this is an interesting system. It's an interesting system.
It is, you know, because clearly the Reds have given up trying at the major league level in a lot of ways, right? They have an owner that I think is more interested in making comments in the public than actually spending money, given where they are right now. But listen, they do have a legitimately good farm system. And I don't think you could have said that even a couple of years ago. Some of that is internal development, which I don't know if people recognize that they are above average, I think, when it comes to player development. And then they've also made some trades that have certainly boosted the system, you know, with the Luis Castillo trades. But I mean, Jarrett, with the major league team where it is, I think it's very obvious where this team's focus is.
Yeah, so they've traded away like a lot of good players in the last couple of years. You know, they traded away Luis Castillo to the Mariners, who was willing to sign a decent market extension. They traded Tyler Molly to the Twins. They traded before the season Jesse Winker and Eugenio Suarez also to the Mariners.
Yeah.
They traded Sonny Gray to the Twins. So they've only traded with two teams, but they traded with them repeatedly, basically. And that's a lot of the prospects on here. You look at our top 10, Eli De La Cruz is an IFA, Noel V. Marte they got in trade, Cam Collier was the first round pick this past year, Edwin Arroyo they got in trade, Connor Phillips they got in trade, Spencer Steer they got in trade, Christiana Encarnacion Strand they got in trade, and then the next three guys were top two round picks from the last couple of years. So it's basically all, except for Eli, it's basically all recent high draft picks or guys they picked up in trade. And they've kind of, so the Reds were, I don't know if you call them early adopters, but they were the first team that I think brought driveline guys in mass. Well, I guess the Rangers did for a few brief periods in time, but they hired Kyle Bodies. I don't remember what title he had, but basically like the minor league pitching director. And they brought in Derek Johnson as the major league pitching coach and overall director of pitching. And, you know, he's got some ideas on how pitching works that, have become pretty far in vogue, right? You know, Derek Johnson's one of the better pitching coaches and pitching development guys in the entirety of baseball. He was at Vanderbilt previously and kind of bounced around back and forth between different teams. But he's kind of a little bit forward thinking. And, you know, they've maybe kind of slid back from that, or at least slid back towards the pack over the last couple of years. But you see some trends. They tend, you know, tends to be high spin pitchers. Hitters that have a lot of power and hit up on the ball, your modern sort of baseball players and the sorts of things we think about. There's a lot of, you know, kind of similar trends in this system, similar types of prospects they traded for, you know, Christiana Encarnacion Strand and like Sal Stewart, that's a guy they traded for who was a college pick a couple of years ago from the Twins, and then a high school pick are both kind of broadly similar prospects, you know, kind of big hulking third basemen that maybe aren't third basemen and just like hit up on the ball constantly. And you can even see that in developmental trends with guys that were already in the organization. Matt McClain was maybe more of a contact first guy at UCLA and is now kind of hitting up and trying to smack the ball. And this hasn't always been positive. They've got a lot of swing and miss in their system too. Yeah, so that's kind of the general trend as to where we are with the Reds. It is a very good farm system. I think by the time people listen to this, the farm rankings are going to be out. I don't actually have the updated ones in front of me, but in the book, we had them ranked fourth. I would expect they're going to rank somewhere right around there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see any reason why they would be considerably higher or lower than that. And,
right.
You know, I think
they're they're in a cluster with the Rays, the Cardinals, the Twins.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Guardians. They're pretty, you know, to me, the Orioles and the Dodgers are pretty far ahead of everybody else.
I wouldn't blame you for including the Guardians in that.
Yeah, duo, yeah, that's fair. But a lot of that depends on what you think of. The Guardians have a lot of pitchers with health risk. You know?
Yeah. Yep.
Daniel Espino just missed 6 months with shoulder problems. Gavin Williams had a lot of medical red flags coming out of the draft. We talked about on that for all you kids out there. Fangraphs actually wrote about them recently in depth. They're not even just the whispers anymore. Yep. So it's like, yeah, these guys, you know, there's a lot of upside in this system, and it has the potential to be really good, but there's also look, they got 8 hitters in this top 10. How confident are you that any of them are actually above average major league regulars, individually?
Yeah.
So on aggregate, they project, but would it shock you if Ellie De La Cruz just swung way too much at everything? Right. Would it shock you if Noel V. Marte just didn't really ever get his power into games? If Cam Collier's projection stalled out, if Edwin Arroyo didn't make enough contact and just ended up being a utility guy, if Spencer Steer didn't have enough power and just ended up being a utility guy, Encarnacion Strand strikes out too much, Sal Stewart's bat doesn't develop and he ends up at first base. You can see downside for all of these players. They don't have that single, they don't have Marcelo Mayer in their system where it's
right. They don't have Anthony Volpe.
High probability to be a plus regular at some point. So that's a little bit tough.
It is. But, you know, to your point, that does present upside. And, you know, contrary to what some other teams, what their farm system's composed of, it does seem like there is consistency in the types of players that they acquire. Now, whether or not you think those are the right players is one thing, but they are sticking to this philosophy, and I do think it's more data-driven than some other teams. So you would hope that a lot of the advancements that they had in pitching development when they went to Driveline and some other facilities to hire their guys, you would hope that that does translate and transcend Kyle Bodie, who, by the way, is not with the organization anymore.
But yes, he left about a year ago, if I recall correctly.
Yep. But let's break down these individual players. I mean, Ellie De La Cruz is, how do I say this? Is he the most contentious top 10, let's call it, prospect in baseball? I think there is a case that he is.
So I called him incomparable. I wrote about him during the season. He's almost not contentious anymore because we kind of all broadly agree. And when I say all, I'm talking about public prospect writers. I know everybody else pretends they don't read everybody else's stuff. I stopped doing that a couple of years ago. It's pointless. Of course I know where everybody else has Ellie De La Cruz ranked. I'm on Twitter all the time.
Yeah.
People tag me in the fucking tweets, man. Everybody just kind of has De La Cruz around the middle or the bottom of the top. We had him fifth on the 101, and we talked a lot about that. And, you know, there were cases for him to be fourth or seventh, but it wasn't it's kind of the, okay, so Ellie De La Cruz has some of the best 90th percentile exit velocity in the minors. He has probably the best bat speed of any prospect in the minors from both sides of the plate, too.
From a 6'5 frame, you know.
He's an 80 runner at 6'5. He's got incredible body control and agility, too. So here's the downside, and you're going to get different numbers on this because you're sourcing it out from teams. I know Kylie McDaniel at ESPN had a little bit lower of a chase rate number than we did, but it's in the mid to high 30s.
Yeah.
And
that's probably what, a 40? If you had to grade in the 2080? anywhere from a 3 to 4, right?
So if that's his major league one, it's a 30 or a 40.
Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing. Guys that chase 36, 38, 39% of the time in high A and double A tend to chase in the 40s in the majors, and that's 20.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the breaking balls get tougher to lay off of, not easier. Not a lot of guys that can locate the slider 4 inches down and away like Max Scherzer can, right?
Yeah.
And he can hit some of those pitches, but that being said, his analytic, his O contact is awful. His zone contact, he is not just chasing pitches that are like right off of the zone and he can foul off. He's chasing curveballs in the dirt that he can't hit with a cricket bat.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and O contact is not a tremendously sticky stat that people talk about a lot. Right. But that's why his strikeout rates are so. So you talk about a guy who's got a Z contact in the low 80s that's running like mega high strikeout rates. It's because he's not just swinging at pitches outside the zone. He's swinging at pitches outside the zone that he cannot contact.
And is that going to be something that...
And it's especially breaking balls low out of the zone.
Right. And is that an aggressiveness, or is it truly an inability to lay off of pitches that he thinks are strikes or start of strikes and then break off?
So it's hard to say because he's just so successful overall that he's never had to make the adjustments such that we'd be able to figure that out.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, you can look at his triple slash lines, and it's just like, you know, in high A, 302, 359, 609. In double A, 305, 357, 553.
And that's that double A slash line was good for a 96 DRC plus.
Right.
Which,
yeah, because he's running a 420 BABIP. Because A, he hits the ball so hard, and B, he's an 80 runner.
Yeah,
he ain't going to run no 420 BABIP in the majors. That doesn't happen for any period of time.
So
what happens when this guy, when all of a sudden that's a 220 on Memorial Day, and the strikeout rate, which, again, I looked really hard to find a successful major league player that was running strikeout rates as high as he has in the minors. And all of the guys that were doing it also walked a ton. And he doesn't walk much either, because again, you're talking chase rates, 36, 38. You don't walk a whole lot doing that. Now we don't have, even teams don't have this batted ball chase type data going back past the mid to late 2010s. That's when like the comprehensive databases started becoming available. But we do have, you know, kind of broader statistics going back further, and we don't have any of that in like a public sector form that we could really look at and see, okay, is there a comparable prospect? But I looked for some statistical markers and I couldn't find one. Now, that being said, an old Bill James theory is that uniqueness is a sign of greatness too, right? So if he's a completely unique player that has like no comparable, like what if Javier Baez was 6'6" and an 80 runner? Like that's like what we're talking about here. You know, people comp him to O'Neill Cruz all the time. I actually
he's better than O'Neill Cruz.
I don't like that as a comp.
Yeah.
It's
literally just because they both hit the ball hard and are tall. I mean,
that's right. It's like a body look comp, and those are the types of comps we're trying to get away from.
That's a trap. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. Like it looks like O'Neill Cruz, but it's not.
He's a better athlete than O'Neill Cruz.
Yes. And that's weird to say because O'Neill Cruz is also an 80 runner. But he doesn't have that incredible body control.
No.
And it's just kind of, it's a different swing plane too, like considerably different swing plane.
Yeah.
So I don't know here. I think Ellie De La Cruz is going to be a really good major league player in some form. I think he is the single most prospect, the single most likely prospect in the minor leagues to win like multiple MVP awards. He's probably also the single most likely prospect, at least in like the top 25 position players, to not really have a significant major league career at all. Because
yeah,
there's an outcome where pitchers just start spamming him, breaking balls in the dirt. He doesn't adjust, and he's a quad A player. Like, he's a nifty utility guy because of his speed and his power, but, like, you know, that becomes really tough. I don't know if he's going to make that adjustment. I'll say this. People in the Reds organization, other journalists I've talked to that have interviewed and profiled him, other team scouts all say that this kid is the highest makeup kid, the highest mental skills that like they've ever dealt with. So if you're talking about he needs to make one adjustment, which is ultimately, it's not necessarily a mental adjustment. It can be, but it can also be like a reaction adjustment. But it's not like a physical like bulk adjustment or something like that. Like it's a reaction and mental adjustment. You think you're going to bet on the kid that everybody raves about the makeup, right? Because you know you don't have the question that he's not going to put in the work or he's not going to try to get there. And I don't put a lot. Look, makeup is really important. Really, really important.
Yep.
But I don't have any ability to measure it. What gets on the public side, makeup is a catch-all for doesn't work hard, doesn't learn, is an asshole to his teammates, is an asshole to
all the OOTP personality traits.
Right. Yeah. It picks up, you know, that's bad makeup can cover anything from, you know, this guy is abusive towards women to, you know, this guy doesn't stay late to put in extra video work, right? And everything in between.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we tend not to, again, it's important, but we don't have any ability to value it on the outside. And frankly, team people I've talked to some of them have become less skeptical that they have any ability to usefully evaluate it.
Yeah, because it's as subjective a evaluation as anything in baseball.
Yes. But that being said, De La Cruz is one of the guys where there's like no dissent that he's a really high, and specifically on the mental skills aspects and the work aspects, there's like no dissent that he's a really hard worker and really adaptable. So if you're talking about he's going to have to make an adjustment to be a successful major league player, maybe you wait a little more towards him being able to make that adjustment because of that. It's at least something that we thought about. Didn't put a lot of weight in it, but it's at least something that deserves mention. But look, I mean, you know, as he is, he would probably get eaten alive in the majors. I have no idea what level they're going to put him at to start this season.
I would imagine double A.
They're going to have him repeat double A coming off of a 900 OPS. Like, I don't know.
It's possible.
Yeah,
it's possible,
they could send him to triple A. The absolute worst thing they could do is rush this kid to the majors.
That's what I'm saying. It's just give him another month in double A, then give him the rest of the season triple A. And listen, if he gets to 300 plate appearances in triple A and he's killing it, then call him up. By all means, call him up. But to your point, like, this is a volatile enough skill set where, and they are not going anywhere in the standings, where you would be doing him a massive disservice by rushing him, you know? So I'm with you. And just to kind of put a bow on him, right? The OFP is a 70, and I think, you know, again, when you reach a 75th percentile outcome, that is baking in that his chase rate would improve, right? Like, that would signify that he is at, you know, below average, a 45 grade chaser, right?
Even if he gets a 45. If he's a 45 grade chaser, he's going to make at least 5 all-star teams,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Unless he gets hurt or something else happens. Yeah, if he gets if his major league chase rate gets to like 32%, this guy's going to have a ton of black ink.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So let's put a number to that. What do you think are the actual odds that it gets to low 30s, like you suggested at this
point? About 25 or 30%.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we talked about that because we talked about putting an 80 extreme on him. Now, in the time I've been at BP, we've put an 80 OFP on three prospects. So this is back to, it's between 2016 and 2023. We've put an 80 OFP on three prospects. Ronald Acuna, Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Okay, those ones are good. And Victor Robles. That one didn't work out.
Oh, what? Oh, what? I thought Alex Reyes was an 80 at one point. Okay.
I don't think it was while I was at BP.
Okay. May have been in a previous time. Got it.
Maybe he was. Three hitters, let's say.
Yeah.
You know, we talked about it with Wander Franco. We didn't see enough of an impact, like, MVP outcome there. And I think so far that's probably borne out.
Injuries have played a part in there, but sure, yeah.
We talked about it with Sixto Sanchez. We decided there was too much injury risk.
Yeah.
We talked about it with Ellie. It would have been weird to run an 80 below 470s. But I think if you're solely looking from a kind of heuristic perspective, you can argue for it.
Oh, yeah.
But, like, people wouldn't have... We ultimately decided that, like, people wouldn't have understood what we were trying to get at with that, basically. And therefore, it just wasn't worth doing.
Yeah, like, it's important to differentiate that the OFP is the 75th percentile. It does not necessarily quantify the chances of that player reaching that outcome.
Yeah, and I don't know what we're supposed to do at this point. Look, again, I'm not going to pretend that other sites don't exist. So we use OFP. ESPN and Fangraphs use FV, which is tied to six-year WAR. And that's kind of become the default that people use, again, just because that's two large sites. The two writers of that those sites co-wrote a book about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, people sometimes think that OFP is FV, and then why are your ranking, why are your numbers higher? And then Prospects Live uses OFP, but, like, has a slightly different formulation for it.
Yeah.
So it's the same term, but a different thing. Baseball America and The Athletic, I think BA still uses some type of rule outcome. Athletic doesn't use anything at all, doesn't use any grades at all. So it's like, I really wish we could just, like, all come together and decide to use one rating, but, like, I don't think half of the people I mentioned previously would want to be in a room with me at any given time, so that's just, like, not going to happen.
Yeah.
And also, we're just, like, so from, like, a valuistic perspective, like, what we're doing with OFP and what Eric and Kylie doing with FP are, like, essentially unreconcilable. One of us would have to change.
Yeah.
And I don't love that FV idea because I don't like the idea of tying this to team control WAR. You know, we define OFP as a 75th percentile roll outcome for, like, a 3-year peak. And I think that's it's more interesting to talk about projected 3-year peaks than to talk about projected 6-year WAR.
Because I agree there.
You end up with, like, some really weird outcomes when you're talking about 6-year WAR. If we were talking about 6-year WAR, we would have Spencer Steer much higher on this list, for example.
Right.
He's already a major league player and has a relatively high floor. So, you know, he might be, I don't know, fourth on this list instead of sixth. And that also would put him on the 101.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. But Ellie's, like, one of these weird cases where – slight changes in how you evaluate and rank are going to kind of move him around a decent amount, because his, with him, it's all about the upside, and maybe the median outcome is a little bit lower. And certainly like the 30th or 40th percentile outcome is a lot lower than, say, Gunnar Henderson.
Yeah, right. Like the floor is probably a better Ronnie Mauricio, right?
Right. So it's like, what are you actually talking about with floors? I wrote an article about 5 years ago on this. Like, everybody's floor is they blow out of the majors. You know, guys get hurt. Guys die. Have career-ending injuries. Guys don't hit, you know?
Yeah.
Jesus Montero. You know, when Jesus Montero was a prospect, people thought his floor was like a platoon DH, and his floor was actually that he was out of the majors by the time he was 27. You know, there's just like, there's, so like, what are we pegging floor as? Are we pegging floor as 10th percentile outcome, as 25th percentile outcome, as first percentile outcome? Because if it's first, everybody's floor is that they're not in the majors. If it's,
yeah, 10, absolutely.
Most players' floor is that they're like quad A guys. 25th is like when you start. That's, I, when I talk about reasonable floor, I'm usually talking about like 20th, 25th percentile outcome. And yeah, Gunnar Henderson's 20th percentile outcome is like, it's probably like a platoon third base, like a strong side platoon third baseman, like league average strong side platoon third baseman. Ellie's is like an up and down speed utility guy. So that's like a lot worse.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It is. But listen, I mean, the 75th percentile outcome does insinuate that he does improve in the chase rate and other facets of his game.
Yeah.
And when you factor in that the 75th percentile outcome, yeah, it's a 7. And guess what? If he hits that 90th percentile outcome, he's an 8.
Yes.
So, that, you know, that is the way to think about this.
Most players in, like, the top 20, their 75th their 90th percentile outcome is an 8. Like,
that's just, you know. True. Yeah. But I think that's also, I mean, yeah, absolutely. But that's why we have them in the top 10. I think, you know, other sites are going to conclude the same thing. Their process is going to be different. But I think, again, this is one of the players that we're in synchrony, I think, across the scouting industrial complex, that he is a top 10 prospect in baseball. Number 2 on the list, not quite a top 10 prospect, but certainly a 101 guy, is Noel V. Marte, previously with the Mariners, as Jared alluded to. He got traded in the Luis Castillo deal. And, you know, listen, he came over from Seattle, went to high A, continued in high A, and did fairly well, right? Now, the question with him is that, is he going to have a carrying offensive tool, and will that profile stick it short? Those are the two main questions I think people have about Marte.
Yeah, so Mark, look, if I was writing this list, if I was writing this list with absolutely no having to, like, stick to our 101, Cam Collier would be ahead of Marte, and Edwin Arroyo might be, too. I am a little more out on Marte than the rest of our staff. I don't know. It's supposed to be his power. If you look at visual scouting reports, they will tell you he has plus-plus power.
Not only
has it not really shown up in games, so if you watch him at 5 p.m., he has plus-plus power. His sluggings have been, like, all right. His exit velocities are all right. His 90th percentile exit velocities are all right. They're, like, 55s. They're not 7s.
Mm-hmm.
So you can split the difference and call it a 6. It's not a lot of bat speed. It's, like, physical strength. He's kind of filled out. His hit tool projection's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong here. It's just not, like, obvious. Like, he might just be, like, a 55 hit, 55 power guy.
And that would be useful if he was a shortstop, right?
Right. So he's been a shortstop. He ended up at third in the act. Nobody's ever thought he was going to stick at shortstop, like, is like a serious likelihood. He ended up at third in the Arizona Fall League. And just, again, I don't like to overplay Arizona Fall League stuff. I think it gets greatly overvalued by the public scouting community because it's easy to scout. Everything's right there for you. So everybody goes and it's an event and you see all the players. He went to the Arizona Fall League and played third base there and, you know, just didn't look like a third baseman. Awful. What is this guy doing out there?
Yeah.
Couldn't make the throws from the position, couldn't do the footwork for the position. So that now raises, so what is he at that point? Second base, right field. Now you're talking about non-shift-aided second baseman. You're talking about corner outfielder. And now we're starting to talk about, okay, what does he actually do better than, Michael Bush at that point, right?
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm a little more out on Marte. There are other people on staff who are still really in on him. Nathan Graham is still really in on him, and he had live looks on him this year. Our Cal League guys who had seen him previously are still mostly in on him. So I don't know. That's kind of a tough one. He was really tough to rate on the 101. We just kind of middled everybody's opinions, and I think we stuck him somewhere in the 30s.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so he was one of the more contentious guys. Cam Collier's on the list was really hard to rank.
Yeah, let's talk about Cam because
this is weird, right?
Like a 17-year-old that went to junior college and not only did well but dominated. And right, so Chipola College is not
Luke Collier's son. If you remember Luke Collier, the old utility player from the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the only other player that took this kind of path was Bryce Harper. But what this did was this made him a 17-year, 8-month draftee that was out of the college ranks and had done really well at Chipola against top-level junior college competition.
Yeah, very good junior, yeah.
Showed up in the Cape, looked pretty good at the Cape. You know, was only there for, I think, 2 weeks. Went to the Combine, tested really well at the Combine. 17 years, 7 months. Okay. If you're running a certain type of amateur draft model, this guy is going to look like the best prospect in years. If you're running a draft model that more strongly weights high-level batted ball inputs, maybe not so much. But yeah. The teams that were really heavy on age relative and top-line performance relative to age, relative to competition, absolutely loved this guy. There was discussion that he was in play as high as the first overall pick. The Reds floated him to 18 for a big bonus, $5 million, which is top 10 money.
Yeah.
And then, depending on where you saw him or if you were doing analytics, what data set you were using, you got very different opinions on what his present skill set was. The general consensus was that for his age, his bat to ball and swing decisions were really good. His exit velocities at times have been really good and at times haven't been. He shows a lot of physical strength. There's some scouting concern that he's a little maxed out.
Yeah.
Quality of contact was flagged to us as a concern by some people. It's like a nice quick swing.
And still is just 18.
Yeah, he just turned 18. He's a good third baseman, but a lot of 18-year-old third basemen are not 26-year-old third basemen, even ones that are pretty good at third base at 18. He's not a small guy either.
No, he's not.
So it's like, so what he is right now, he's a hit tool driven player who has barely played against. Actually, may not have played at all.
I don't think he played at all. Yeah. Yeah.
That all he's done against pro pitching is taken some backfield at bats in the complex. And with this type of, and we're going to talk about this to Sal Stewart too in a minute, with this type of hit tool, it's generally nice to have some type of upper level performance, whether that's major conference D1 or pro. And we don't have either of those with Camp Collier or the Cape Cod League for more than 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is the one that I think we're the least certain about in terms of ranking. Yeah. You know, a lot of it is going off of what we've heard from people that we've come to trust in the scouting and analytical circles, right?
Yeah.
So it's a lot of back sourcing and thus I think a lot of rightly so uncertainty there with Cam Collier, but no doubt the upside is apparent. The skill set is pretty well defined, and I think you could make the case that teams, at least more of the analytical teams, will look at a player's contact rate. They'll look at, you know, this is where I think the convergence of analytics and scouting comes into play, right? Because he very clearly has good bat to ball skills, right? And you think he's got a nice swing and some bat speed. That's where I think maybe teams look at and say, we can develop exit velocity much easier than we can actually develop contact rates, right? So I think that would be the case.
That's an interesting question.
Theoretically, you can.
Yeah.
In the way that people kind of with pitchers think that it's kind of like you can't necessarily help a pitcher improve their command as easily as you theoretically could help them improve their velocity, right? That's the Cleveland Guardians philosophy.
The Cleveland Guardians way.
Yeah.
Yes.
So you could make the case that that's why Cam Collier is where he is on this list. I don't know if I wholeheartedly believe that, but I don't think that's you can completely discredit that either, right? Because if you think about it, it's incredibly difficult to put bat to ball, right? Yeah. But what if you could actually swing the bat a little bit harder with a swing in which you already do make contact? Just a question.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of where we're at with Collier.
Yeah. So, but
he's interesting. He's really interesting.
He is. And another guy that's interesting that was also acquired in the Luis Castillo trade, Edwin Arroyo. And,
yeah,
you know, listen, unlike Marte, we are pretty confident Arroyo is going to be a shortstop, right? He's got the arm. He's
a second baseman.
Yeah, comfortably.
He's a slick infielder.
Yeah, he could be a third baseman, second baseman, shortstop, but I don't think the batted ball quality is quite as good, and maybe that's why he's a little lower than Marte on the totem pole.
We got feedback dating back to the time of the trade, so mid-season, that Arroyo was a better prospect than Marte. We got feedback for the mid-season 50 that Arroyo should be ahead of Marte.
Yeah.
That is something that many people in the scouting community think. We didn't put him there. He had a crappy time after the trade for a month.
Stuff happens, yeah.
Right. His bat to ball is not, like, great. So this is, like, I called it adequate. It's, like, adequate approach and bat to... He was supposed to be coming out of high school, like, an approach and bat to ball guy, and instead hit the ball a lot harder, but didn't really have the approach or the bat to ball that was expected. I love these guys that are the exact opposite of what you expect. Colton Cowser is turning out to be this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an entertaining thing to have happen, right? Yeah. So Colton Cowser is supposed to be this contact and quality of contact corner outfielder, and instead he's just trying to uppercut everything to the moon, but he can probably play center. So Arroyo's, you know, the defense is good. It's for his age, it's really good. He played the entire season, pretty much the entire season, except for like the last 2 weeks, at 18 in low A, which is, you know, age is important, and had a nice season. Maybe not quite as nice as the top line, that is a Modesto Cal League line, right?
So yeah, only 6% above league average per DRC+.
Right, so there's some air in there.
Yep.
But yeah, real nice prospect, real nice get. Scout favorite.
Stick it short. You know, I think that would probably be the case for him above Marte.
Yeah, we think it's more likely he's going to stick it short, yeah.
Yeah, I think that would be the case there. Number five, you know, this pitcher, Connor Phillips, is sort of you can identify teams that like analytical friendly profiles just by looking at the pitchers they trade for. And yeah. Connor Phillips is a good example of this.
Yeah, and the pitchers they draft, too.
Absolutely. I got to be honest. I'm excited. I'm excited about him. The command is problematic at this point.
Yeah, but, that's an understatement.
Yeah. But the stuff is undeniable at this point.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's mid-90s. It's the modern flat up in the zone, swing and miss stuff. You know, two breaking balls, similar velocity band, but different movement. Both have plus potential. Doesn't really throw a whole lot of changes and can't really hit his spots.
Yeah.
A lot of people think he's going to be a closer.
Yeah. Could he just be the next Matt Brash? A guy that we want to start, but probably is a reliever, but a really good one at that?
Yeah. We think there's enough chance he starts that we had him in the 1-on-1. But it was close, you know.
Right. The 75th percentile probably gets him to about mid-rotation. But, you know, once you start getting into the 60th or even 55th, that's where the reliever risk comes into play. But, yeah, I mean, these are the kinds of, like, there are two types of pitchers that I generally like to invest in. I like to invest into guys that have this incredibly loud stuff, and if they can even get similar to Ellie De La Cruz, if his chase rate gets even below average, he's going to be great. If Connor Phillips can just get his not even command but control to below average, he could be a back end starter with that kind of stuff.
Right.
So,
and you know, we've seen more guys fastball and two breaking balls as an Arsenal second starter recently. So,
yeah. Absolutely.
That's not as much of a concern as it would have been even like 5 years ago, where you used to say that, okay, this guy can't start. Now maybe this guy can start. Like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. We'll take a quick break. We've just done the first five in the top 10. We'll come back with the back half and also Jared's personal cheese ball. We'll be right back. Right, we are back for the back end of the top 10 here for the Cincinnati Reds prospect list. Spencer Steer, being number six, is another guy that the Reds traded for. He was acquired in the Tyler Mahle trade. And, you know, it was interesting because when he entered pro ball, he was more of a guy that, yeah, he might hit the ball hard, but he doesn't really lift it. Kind of the Brett Beatty situation.
He doesn't actually hit the ball that hard, though, which is interesting. But yeah, generally.
Yeah, but he did lift the ball this year, which I think he was
lifting the ball a lot.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, the results spoke for themselves in AA and even in AAA. You know, he was anywhere from 19 to 30% better than league average. But, you know, what really stood out for you when ranking Steer, other than the fact that he's already reached the major leagues?
Yeah, I mean, it's upper level production. He can kind of stand at a bunch of different spots. I don't really think he can play shortstop. I think he's probably a third baseman. Most ideally, he can stand at short. He's okay at second. He plays good first, but now all of a sudden you're talking about first base offensive carrying. You know, he's lifting the ball a lot. He's not really hitting the ball that hard. He's good swing decisions, got above average plate discipline. The swing's kind of wonky. It's like he's a guy who's really likely to be like a really good fifth infielder, second division starter with a little bit on top of that, but like not a ton. Like, it's actually kind of hard to get him to a six unless he keeps this power up, even though he's not like the fundamentals for this type of power are just like not really there. They're kind of there.
Yeah.
So yeah. it's a little tough. That's why he wasn't in the 101. He wasn't that far off. He probably would have been like the 110s.
Yeah. He just missed the just missed article, I think.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
I don't think we put him in the just missed article.
No, I don't think we did.
He was like right around there. Like, it was a tough, you know, there were like iterations of the 101 he was on. Nobody was really pounding the table for him internally.
But I think really that's what happens when you don't have a standout offensive tool and you play third base.
Right. Nobody was really pounding it for him externally either. Like,
yeah,
you know, we had people really pounding the table, like in the scouting community, for like James Altman. And we had like analysts really pounding the table for Chase the Water. And like, that just wasn't like we weren't getting that for Spencer Steer. Again, that's telling you something, right?
Yeah, not nothing. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you this. I mean, I know we have Christian Encarnacion Strand behind Steer, and I imagine that's because we have a little bit more confidence that Steer could play third base. Strand is probably a first base only prospect.
Yeah, Strand's not going to be able to play.
Yeah, yeah. So he hits the ball hard. He lifts a lot, but a lot needs to go right offensively. If it doesn't break out offensively at the major league level, it's going to be difficult for him to carry a starting offensive position. But at the same time, the OFP does account for a at least somewhat breakout offensively.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, you could have put Encarnacion Strand fifth or sixth on this list, right?
I think so. Yeah, if you really buy the offensive breakout, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I think he's a first baseman. He does, like, he hits the ball really hard, but, you know, his bat to ball is not good. Yeah. He chases a ton out. He chases as much out of the zone as De La Cruz does.
And he doesn't have literally eight raw power.
Right. So, I mean, he has seven.
Like, he does not have seven. Yeah, he has seven.
You know, he had 32 homers last year, and the exit velocity is there. Yeah. But it's like, you know, Ellie De La Cruz, but without the contact speed or defense, that's a one-dimensional slugger profile.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, it looks like it. And look, for a guy that was a fourth-round pick and was the second-best prospect in that, they were both in the Molly trade, and Encarnacion at the time, Strand at the time of the trade, was considered a more distant second prospect than he was the third prospect we're going to talk about in a minute, too.
Yeah.
You know, that's a nice outcome, and that's a, you know, it's a nice, you got two guys that have a chance to be decent regulars and a pitcher that's got a chance to be pretty interesting.
Yeah.
For Tyler Molly, that's a pretty good piece of business there, I think.
Yeah. I think, like, the case for Molly's always kind of been that upside that we still haven't seen, really.
Right. Gets hurt a lot.
Gets hurt a ton. Yeah. Yeah.
But I got Sal Stewart. It's kind of the same broad type of profile, kind of a, you know, and you see these, you know, this is another archetype. He's,
yep.
I made in the annual for him and the Castellanos joke, because, you know, it's a high school third baseman from Florida, big guy. Nobody really thinks he's a third baseman.
And it's funny because
they got him with the Nick Castellanos comp pick. That's why I made that joke.
And I think that, you know, it's even better because he does have the power profile to hit the ball to deep left field.
Yeah, that was the joke. Yeah. You know, where does he end up? Third base?
I think he's probably a first baseman.
So now we're talking about a right high school first baseman, which is everybody's favorite profile, right?
Yeah. But he does have this chance for
right, yeah,
plus hit and power, and the OFP accounts for that. So
you look on the showcase circuit, and for guys that were on the, and he was a very, I don't know, famous is the right word, because it's, you know, prep prospect, but he was a high profile prep prospect. He played in all these showcases, and his swing decision, bat to ball, exit velocity data was like really good for those. And again, you can kind of see archetypes here. So, you know, there's a chance for him to get to that like six hit, six power to carry the first base position. But this is is another one where we kind of got to see some of this in pro ball, and we really haven't seen it in pro ball yet.
Yeah. Yeah. We're always a little weary with guys that were drafted or guys that were playing the Dominican. You know, the Dominican stat lines are always deceptive. And of course, we don't have.
So these are both complex league concepts. And the complex league is, you know, I've made the argument that they should not keep stats in the complex league because it just deceives people. So, guys, you know, you see the Arizona Complex League, the Florida Complex League, the Dominican Summer League. Those are 2-month slices of 8 or 9 month developmental processes for those players. They're playing a lot of other games. They just don't take stats for them.
Right. Yeah, exactly. That's another thing people don't really, I think, realize. Yeah. I imagine that Sal Stewart got plenty of plate appearances that just weren't tracked in actual games, but you can make the case that, you know, they were as competitive as, you know, the.
But the Florida Complex League is not a super competitive environment.
No, it's not. No.
So, yeah.
So, moving on to number 9 is a guy that actually did play quite extensively and had a healthy season in 2022. Matt McClain, you mentioned it. He was a hit for contact kind of guy coming out of UCLA. But all of a sudden, 2022 comes around and he's hitting for decent power. He's making a concerted effort to do so.
Yeah, this is another guy where, you know, he's drafted as contact first middle infielder. Now he's a stomp and lift guy. Funnily enough, he's not actually lifting it that much more. He is hitting the ball a little bit harder when he does lift it, but he's also swinging through an awful lot of hittable pitches now. We're going to talk about this in a minute with Austin Hendrick. And we're going to talk about this with Alan Sar. Like, this
do we
like,
really have to talk about it with Austin Hendrick, though?
I don't know. But there's just like, these guys are all suddenly swinging and missing like inordinate amounts of times once they're in the pro. And this is the downside of kind of what the Reds are doing.
Right.
I have never been a huge Matt McClain fan, like even dating back to like when I was in high school. I never really loved his swing playing.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, but he's got a chance to, you know, it's middle infield. He's got some pop in the past. He's shown good bat to ball. He's got swing decisions. That's like the basis of a good profile, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think he's an athlete, right? So like you do talk about floor and it's kind of like, well, what is it? But I do think there is he is a high probability major leaguer at this point, right? Yeah. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say.
Listen, if a guy gets to the major leagues, I don't care it somewhat matters in what capacity, but even if he's a bench player, a role player, and you draft him in the first round, altogether that's a success. I don't think people realize that, right? Yeah. So, you know, the Reds have done a good job drafting. And if Matt McClain gets to the majors and even is a role player at worst, that's overall a success for him. So
yeah.
I think it's important to, you know, reiterate that sometimes because we look at first round picks and we think that every single one of them has to pan out, you know, and Matt McClain does not need to pan out completely to a 75th percentile outcome like the OFP suggests to be a valuable player in the major league. So
yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah. Number 9 is the lefty Andrew Abbott. He was drafted in the second round of the 2021 draft. How do I say this about Virginia pitchers, Jarrett? they're not
maximized in college.
Yeah, they suddenly have stuff jumps in professional baseball, right? Is the nicer way to say it. But you know, he did feature some pretty incredible strikeout rates throughout, you know, not necessarily the low minors. You know, he pitched 91 innings in double A last year. He had another 27 in high A, but you know, he's got the yip sometimes. Like, he doesn't have perfect command, but overall it's an intriguing enough skill set, I think, for him to sneak into the top 10 here.
Yeah. You know, this is another high spin kind of power profile fastball, really big spinny curveball. Mm-hmm. Changeup's not there yet.
Yeah.
Command is a problem.
And I think the fact that, you know, the changeup is not there is probably the reason that he's, you know, 10th. And yes. why Phillips is considerably higher.
Again, so you've got all these maximized guys, and you've got all these guys that have designed pitches, and just like all of them have command problems, and yep. A lot of them also have health problems. So this is kind of like, it's a version of like the portfolio approach, right? Mm-hmm. Where you've just got like a lot of guys who have interesting stuff, and you're hoping that a couple of them pop into front of the rotation, major league starters, because you just played the numbers game. But individually, none of these guys really have like a super great probability to be that guy. And Abbott's just kind of in this mix. We'll kind of blow through some more pitchers while we're doing this. Steven Jarr basically has the same profile as Abbott.
Yeah.
Except he's a lot more injured. He's a second rounder out of Michigan a couple of years ago for the Twins. He was the third prospect in the Molly trade.
Yep.
Fastballs up in the zone, two breaking balls, change up, just like whiffs on everything. And the change ups, you know, kind of the, it's the predominant scouting pitch, but like if you throw it into a stuff model, like, and a lot of stuff models have trouble with changeups, but
yes. You know,
this guy's got like some really high spin breaking balls that just like are whiffing a ton of batters.
Right. It's the stuff versus location plus grades, right?
He's got a really weird release point and landing spot, and he keeps getting hurt, which All of this is probably not unrelated. You know, it's like really upright, really violent landing. He loses the strike zone. But you're talking about a guy that's outside the top 10 of this system, that like you could squint and see a top of the rotation outcome here.
Yeah.
Like you could squint and see like Shane McClanahan, right? So
Jarrett.
It's not a comp, it's just it's a, you know, like you actually could do that. Like if you're, you know, now is he really gonna get the health, the command, the tunneling, is all this stuff really going to jump? Probably not. But there were points in time when Shane McClanahan looked like this, too.
Right.
You know, that except was
he was a first round pick. Shane McClanahan,
when he was a 30th overall pick and he had a terrible health record.
That's, yeah.
You know, there were times when he couldn't repeat his release point. He developed his slider very late in his prospectum, which ended up arguably being his best pitch in the majors.
Yeah.
You know, I was a lot higher on Shane McClanahan than he was on our lists, because I generally skew a little more towards the give me the overwhelming stuff, and it, you know, sometimes they're going to figure it out. But, you know, Brandon Williamson's in this vein, too. He's the next guy. Chase Petty's the right-handed version of this pitcher, so... Yeah. Williamson was considered a better prospect than Connor Phillips at the time of the Winker Suarez trade. And he just like lost it during the season. all of us, he had command problems that manifested in inability to get whiffs in the zone and chase outside the zone, which is just a really bad combination.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think he's moving towards the bullpen. His secondary is all flash, but he can't like keep both of them at the same time. He can't keep all of them at the same time. Like, he's low 90s at times. He's been like, you're assuming maybe like he's like mid to high 90s with that hard cutter slider and the pen, and that kind of all works. Chase Petty is a guy that I found very intriguing out of high school. He, it's a South Jersey prep arm, so I actually saw him.
Is he South or Central Jersey, Jarrett?
No, he's South. He's the like Atlantic City area.
Okay. I didn't mean to deviate there. But...
Yeah, he's down in I think he's from Summers Point.
Okay.
But he's a shore kid. He's like a Southern shore kid.
Right.
Kind of a wild. Like, he was up to, like, 102 as a short prep arm, which is just, like, what? Like, he's listed at 6'1". I don't think he's anywhere close to 6'1". And he was up to 102 at times. He was more often, like, 97 to 100. But, like, I saw, like, again, and these are not, this is not an area of great competition. Like, his 100-mile-an-hour fastball would get, like, squared up by, like, some, like, random sophomore on, like, a shore team.
Right.
It's just, like, an awful movement profile, basically.
It is.
Now, he's got a plus-plus slider, and they, like, dialed back his fastball, and in doing so, fixed some of the shape on it. I don't know. Command's a problem. He didn't actually get a ton of swings and misses in A-ball this year. I, like, kind of suspect he's probably, like, we fixed the pitch characteristic problems on the fastball, and then you let him air it out back in the bullpen, and now we're back into the upper 90s and the low 100s with that white belt slider. So now here's another guy that we're talking about probably moving to the bullpen. So, like, every pitcher on this list we've talked about probably moving to the bullpen, which is a problem. Jay Allen, I don't know, man.
Why did they promote him when they did?
Hell if I know. I don't know, man. Like, I don't got an answer. I asked. We thought he was ready for the next level. If you got teenage power bat slugging 330 in low A, you don't promote him, right?
God bless.
Right, like,
yeah,
you know, so he's supposed to be a power guy. He didn't hit the ball that hard. His swing path is a problem. He was just beating the ball into the ground. He's got speed and defense. It's a profile Jeffrey likes a lot more than I do. Jeffrey wanted to put him on the 101 last year, and I was just like,
"That's news. I did not know that."
A year, and we waited a year. Look, I mean, the reports on him in the complex after the draft, the two guys that the reports were like way up on after the draft in the Arizona complexes, out of the prep bats from the 2021 draft, were Jay Allen and James Wood. And Jay Allen is the 14th best prospect in the Red system, and James Wood's the 3rd best prospect in baseball. But a year ago, they were basically at the same point.
He's interesting. And then the one other guy that I want you to touch on, because he has been the source of, not contentious, but aggressive negotiations in our score sheet league, Easmith Pineda, right?
Yeah, sure.
Because
I'm going to talk about him and Carlos Jorge together.
Sure. Go ahead.
So these are two complex guys out of the international complex, and the Reds have done a very good job of the international complex.
Yes.
Especially with the not super huge signings. And these are both mid six figure guys. Pineda was actually 800,000. So it's like 450 and 800. Yeah. and kind of the same kind of broad profile. You know, just kind of like hit first, interesting guys, interesting TrackMan data. So right. Carlos Jorge is also really fast. And you talk about, you know, good power numbers, good speed numbers in the complex league. And what's the next thing that happens? Fantasy dynasty players start getting really excited about that guy.
Yep.
His TrackMan data is not great. Like, it's, you know, the contact, the exit velocity, the swing decisions are all, like, fine for a teenager in the complex. They're not, like, almost 1,000 OPS in the complex with,
yeah,
which is what he's been doing. And also 54 steals in 89 games. His strikeout rate and his contact numbers went in the wrong direction in the Arizona complex as opposed to the Dominican complex.
Yeah.
Again, we talked a half an hour ago about how I'm not sure that they should actually keep stats at these levels. He's interesting. It's a nice kind of simple, low-effort swing. I like him. I don't like him as much as fantasy touts like him. Esmith Pineda is a year behind him. He's still in the DSL. He's way more famous than your... Him and Adon Sanchez were both way more famous than your garden variety, high six-figure, low seven-figure, like 40th on the international rankings, IFAs, because they were both on in the Little League World Series from Panama a number of years ago with a team that I believe ended up winning the Little League World Series. So they're... You know, they had profiles done on them when they were 13 or whatnot. So, I don't know. Like, this guy had really interesting TrackMan data for 3 weeks in the DSL. For 3 weeks in the DSL, he looked like prime Mike Trout. I don't have any idea what that means. I found a little bit of video on him. It looked right. I talked to, like, one person that actually saw him. It was like, yeah, he's interesting. Throw him on the back of your list. So, sure, we threw him on the back of the list.
Yes.
Would it shock me if he was the big star of the complex this year and ended up on the 101 next
year?
No
way.
It shock me if he hit 190 in the complex this year? It would also not shock me if he hit 190. Like, I don't know. Like, it's just... It's more interesting to write about him than some other guys, so we throw him on there.
Yeah.
They got some interesting guys. They got some famous guys at the back. Logan Tanner's been a significant college player for a number of years. Huge arm strength, not great overall arm utility. Occasionally hits the ball really far. Doesn't hit the ball very far often.
Yeah.
Austin Hendrick was a first-round pick a few years ago and just has absolutely no bat-to-ball ability and has...
Yeah, what was it, like a 35% strikeout rate?
37. He has struck out 37% of the time as a pro. It's just like hard, you know. And you, Kurt Sweden, his concerns about him dating back to when he was like 16, so this is not a new problem. He's got... just horrible bat to ball, and he like doesn't have a great approach, but he hits it pretty far when he makes contact.
Yeah.
Joel Boyle is like the platonic ideal of a Reds pitcher in that he has like the greatest pitch characteristics you're ever gonna see and walked 8 guys per 9 this past year. Like, it's just like, yeah,
that is the Reds way, baby.
And somebody I trust, give him like a 7 fastball and a 7 curveball, but it was 2 command.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like, it's like, yeah, this guy had like the best fastball curveball combination I saw this year. Yeah, he's like a 4.
Yeah.
7 fastball, 7 command. I wrote him up as a 4. He's gonna be a pretty good reliever, baby. Victor Acosta, they got from Brandon Drury. He was a big high. He was considered one of the top players in the 2 years ago IFA class. He hasn't like really done a whole lot. That's interesting since then. But sure, yeah, you got him for a Brandon Drury rental. Why not? And then Alan Serd, I don't know. They got they did the non-tender and re-signed with him. I really just wrote him up because I had him at 20 originally, and then the scout I talked about previously convinced me to put Joe Boyle on the list. So I already had his blurb written. He's Alan Serda. It's like he's like the double A version of what like late career Adam Dunn was in the majors.
Yeah.
The problem was when Adam Dunn was in double A, he was a 320 hitter.
What? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, Adam Dunn had a great hit tool when he was a prospect.
Holy no way. I need to see this for myself.
Yeah.
Wow.
Go look up Adam Dunn's minor league stats on baseball.
I'm doing it right now. This is a great podcasting. Yeah. Let's see.
Adam Dunn in 2001 in the Southern League.
Oh my God.
Hit 343, 449, 664.
Throughout the 2021 season.
21-year-old split between the two high minors levels. He spent most of the season in the high minors, hit 334, 444, 671, came up and played 66 games in the majors and hit 262, 371, 578. And he was the same age as Alan Serda is now.
That is absurd. Yeah.
So when you say late career Adam Dunn, but in double A, you have to realize that Adam Dunn, when he was actually in double A, was like the best prospect in baseball. So.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Wow. You learn something new every day. How about that? But Jarrett, we made it through the top 21 prospects in the Cincinnati Red system.
Yeah, we ate up all the time we were going to use to record two podcasts to record one podcast.
Hey, I don't think anyone's complaining.
Which you, in fact, predicted happening ahead of time.
I did, and you're like, no, we can do it. I said, no, we can't do it. Trust me, we can't. But we hope that all of you enjoyed listening to it. I certainly enjoyed this conversation. And Jarrett, thank you again for hopping on, and we will have you on for the Nationals podcast whenever we can get to that one. But that will do it for this particular episode of the Baseball Perspectives Podcast Network. We'll see you guys next time.